must have worked this out for yourself, Derek. And if you've got any wisdom at the end of this, it's great. Daniel chapter 4.
It's a lengthy reading, but I think we need to read it all. It's on page 887 in the Church Bible. And it's entitled Nebuchadnezzar's Dream of a Tree. King Nebuchadnezzar. This is a letter, an open letter to anyone who guesses who's going to read it, to his people. To the peoples, nations, and men of every language who live in all the world, may you prosper greatly. It's my pleasure to tell you about the miraculous signs and wonders that the Most High God has performed for me. You could have written this, Derek, couldn't you, I reckon? How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an eternal kingdom. His dominion endures from generation to generation. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at home in my palace, contented and prosperous. I had a dream that made me afraid. As I was lying in my bed, the images and visions that passed through my mind terrified me. So I commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be brought before me to interpret the dream for me. When the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners came, I told them the dream, but they could not interpret it for me. Finally, Daniel came into my presence, and I told him the dream. He is called Belteshazzar, after the name of my God, and the spirit of the holy gods is in him. I said, Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in you, and no mystery is too difficult for you. Here is my dream. Interpret it for me. These are the visions I saw while lying in my bed. I looked, and there before me stood a tree in the middle of the land. Its height was enormous. The tree grew large and strong, and its top touched the sky. It was visible to the ends of the earth. Its leaves were beautiful, its fruit abundant, and on it was food for all. Under it, the beasts of the field found shelter, and the birds of the air lived in its branches. From it, every creature was fed. In the visions I saw while lying in my bed, I looked, and there before me was a messenger, a holy one coming down from heaven. He called in a loud voice, "Cut down the tree and trim off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the animals flee from under it and the birds from its branches. But let the stump and its roots, bound with iron and bronze, remain in the ground, in the grass of the field. Let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him live with the animals among the plants of the earth. Let his mind be changed from that of a man, and let him be given the mind of an animal, till seven times pass by for him. The decision is announced by messengers. The holy ones declare the verdict, so that the living may know that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and gives them to anyone he wishes and sets over them the lowliest of men. This is the dream that I, King Nebuchadnezzar, had. Now, Belteshazzar, tell me what it means, for none of the wise men in my kingdom can interpret it for me. But you can, because the spirit of the holy gods is in you." And Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, was greatly perplexed for a time, and his thoughts terrified him. So the king said, "Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its meaning alarm you." Belteshazzar answered, "My lord, if only the dream applied to your enemies and its meaning to your adversaries. The tree you saw, which grew large and strong with its top touching the sky, visible to the whole earth, with beautiful leaves and abundant fruit providing food for all and giving shelter to the beasts of the field and having nesting places in its branches for the birds of the air, you, O king, are that tree. You have become great and strong. Your greatness has grown until it reaches the sky, and your dominion extends to distant parts of the earth. You, O king, saw a messenger, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, 'Cut down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump bound with iron and bronze in the grass of the field, while its roots remain in the ground. Let him be drenched with the dew of heaven. Let him live like the wild animals until seven times pass by for him.' This is the interpretation, O king. And this is the decree the Most High has issued against my Lord the King. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like cattle and be drenched with the dew of heaven. 7 times will pass by for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and gives them to anyone he wishes. The command to leave the stump of the tree with its roots means that your kingdom will be restored to you when you acknowledge that heaven rules. Therefore, O King, be pleased to accept my advice. Renounce your sins by doing what is right, and your wickedness by being kind to the oppressed. It may be that then your prosperity will continue. All this happened to King Nebuchadnezzar. 12 months later, as the king was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, he said, "Is not this the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence, by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty?" The words were still on his lips when a voice came from heaven. "This is what is decreed for you, King Nebuchadnezzar. Your royal authority has been taken from you. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like cattle. 7 times will pass by for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and gives them to anyone he wishes." Immediately, what had been said about Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. He was driven away from people and grass, and ate grass like cattle. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair grew like the feathers of an eagle and his nails like the claws of a bird. At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes towards heaven, and my sanity was restored. Then I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified him who lives forever. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as he pleases with the powers of heaven and the peoples of the earth. No one can hold back his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" At the same time, my sanity was restored. My honor and splendor were returned to me for the glory of my kingdom. My advisors and nobles sought me out, and I was restored to my throne and became even greater than before. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven, because everything he does is right, and all his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. When I was reading this during the week, a memory stirred within me of those long-lost Christmas days at home with the family, stuffed up with Christmas pud and lots of turkey. Get to the TV just for 3 o'clock. Or was it a wireless in those days? Maybe a wireless in those days. Just in time for the Queen's speech. That annual attempt to communicate to the people and perhaps to share some wisdom. It's probably a memory that was never true, actually, but you like to think, don't you, of memories like that. And one year recently I was reminded of, it was 1992, in fact. It seems less long ago than that, but the Queen's Annus Horribilis. In that year, Fergie and Andrew separated. Charles and Di separated, Anne and Mark were divorced, and Windsor Castle went on fire. But in that speech that year, the Queen spoke of her faith and trust in God, and has done in the years since, on and off maybe, but nevertheless speaks of her faith. Well, Nebuchadnezzar's speech, letter, in the same vein, perhaps, but in a different league altogether. If we accept that Daniel has written this book, he's the author of this book, then if this is a letter from King Nebuchadnezzar, he's obviously encouraged Nebuchadnezzar to write it and then has included it in this book. It's a testimony from the king. And the whole chapter, if you like, is the story of his journey to faith. The chapter begins and ends with this declaration of the sovereign power of the heavenly King above all kings. whose dominion endures forever. And scattered throughout the story, on the lips of the angel, this divine messenger in verse 17, on the lips of Daniel as he interprets the dream in verse 25, on the lips of the heavenly voice, which speaks directly to Nebuchadnezzar when it comes to pass in verse 32, there is the same message, that the Lord is sovereign. That he gives authority to those he will give authority to in the kingdoms of this earth. And that Nebuchadnezzar had to acknowledge this. And the message, therefore, that's throughout this chapter, for good measure, is the simple message of Daniel to the people that he was writing for, to the people exiled in Babylon, wondering why God had abandoned them, wondering what's happening, what will happen next. And the message is to the rulers of Babylon, and Daniel lives through at least four, I think. Nebuchadnezzar was there when they were taken to Babylon. And then there's Belshazzar, is it, in the next chapter. And Darius after him, and Cyrus after him. And the message is preached to each. And the message is there for you and me today as well. It's a simple message, and yet it's probably the most profound message in the universe, because it's the simple truth about God. And it's there at the end, verse 37, that I, Nebuchadnezzar, or I, Ian Furlong, or I, Derek, sitting in an aeroplane, or I, put your own name in there. Praise and exalt and glorify the King of Heaven, because everything he does is right, and all his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. Well, the story is fairly self-explanatory, isn't it? You note at the start, in Nebuchadnezzar's own words, verse 4, there he was at home in his palace, contented and prosperous. Not a care in the world. He's the owner of everything that this world strives for today, but actually through all times, and probably for time to come as well. But people search after a contentedness. They search after a prosperity, which means they can sit and survey, you know, all that's theirs and think, yeah, I've made it. But of course, the things he doesn't have control over are the things that begin to trouble him. He has a dream in verse 5 that made him afraid. Going on in verse 5 to say that actually the visions that passed through his mind terrified him. And so wise men, magicians, all the king's horses and all the king's men are summoned to interpret this dream for him, but none can. And finally he calls in Daniel, who actually has served a similar purpose just two chapters ago. You'd think it had called him first, wouldn't you? But that would have spoilt the story, wouldn't it, in a way? And verses 8 and 9, perhaps, we just catch a glimpse of Nebuchadnezzar's sort of faith, where he stands at the moment, because he calls Daniel Belteshazzar after the name of his God, which is Bel, and he recognizes, though, that the spirit of the holy gods is in Belteshazzar, and he says this a few times, doesn't he? There's a faith thing going on in his heart, but it's not formed and it's not focused on the one living God, not yet, at least. A tree, enormous, seen by all, shelter and provision to all. The messenger comes and commands that it be cut down and strip its leaves and scatter the fruit, and yet the stump is left bound in bronze and iron, was it, there in the ground. Even in the terror of everything being stripped away, there's still some hope left for the future. And did you notice the change of pronoun in verse 15? From talking about the tree in the sort of third person, it suddenly says, let him be drenched with the dew of heaven. The message is here, actually, for all to see. that God is out to prove who's in charge. Now, I'm no dream interpreter. I try sometimes. Jan has dreams, and we have a laugh, don't we, trying to interpret what they mean. But this one seems fairly obvious to me, isn't it? And yet he calls in Daniel. And as Daniel interprets it, his thoughts terrify him because he knows that this king, who actually has treated Daniel and his friends very well over the years, is in for something of a rude awakening, and not a pleasant rude awakening either. Not just turbulence on a plane, this, oh no. And Daniel's as tactful as he can be, isn't he? Verse 19, Lord, if only the dream applied to your enemies and its meaning to your adversaries. He tries to soften the blow, but actually then comes in as straight as a die. And in verse 20 and following, he describes the tree as you, and it's going to be cut down. And you're going to be insane for 7 years. The scholars reckon that times would be equivalent to our years, seasons, that the cycle of the seasons, 7 times, 7 years. And that wouldn't end until you acknowledge, verse 25, that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and gives them to anyone he wishes. But you see the hope, verse 26, the command to leave the stump of the tree with its roots means that your kingdom will be restored to you when you acknowledge that heaven rules. And so Daniel gives him some advice. Repent. Do good works now. Do some good things, from God to the people. And maybe your prosperity will continue. Well, what would you have done if you'd been Nebuchadnezzar? I think I might have been tempted to do some good works, to restore some righteousness and to stop the wickedness to the oppressed. But hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it? And Nebuchadnezzar didn't have the benefit of that. So 1 year later, it all came to pass. Verse 33, immediately what had been said was fulfilled, and he was driven away from the people and ate grass like cattle. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair grew like the feathers of an eagle and his nails like the claws of a bird. There's a medical condition for this. I didn't write it down, and I can't remember. Zoanthropy or something like that? I don't know. Living like an animal. But in verse 34, the restoration begins. He lifts his eyes to heaven, and his sanity is restored. And he praises God, and he acknowledges his lordship, and then the glory of his kingdom is restored. And the conclusion is, as we've read, that now I praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven, because everything he does is right and all his ways are just, and those who walk in pride he is able to humble. But maybe four things that we can usefully reflect on. The first one is the power of a sovereign God. Sovereign is a word beloved of theologians to describe God. The problem is, I think we tend to think of sovereigns as our earthly kings and queens, whose power is limited. Our queen, in fact, her power is non-existent, isn't it, really? She's a benign figurehead who presides over us in name only, but from a 600-bedroom palace, while the rest of us get on living day to day in the real world. It's my slip show in there. Sorry. But you see, that won't do. That image won't do when we use the word sovereign of God. Because sovereign means he's the supreme ruler. Sovereign power means he has complete and utter control of all things. Anything less, and he isn't God. And this is the God of the Bible. This is the creator of the whole universe, who created with a word, out of nothing. This is the sustainer of the whole universe, who sustains all things by his powerful word. In him we live and move and have our being. Without him, nothing. He rules over the nations. The kings and the princes are like pawns in his hand. The peoples are like dust. Hear this, Nebuchadnezzar. Actually, hear this, George Bush and Tony Blair and David Cameron and anyone else who fancies taking on the role of leading a country, because your authority comes from God. And hear this, Ian Furlong, and hear this, people of Saltersford, this sovereign God, this ruler of all, has the right to demand your worship, your life, your all. This is the power of a sovereign God. Second thing is the pride of a sinful man. See, this is the heart of Nebuchadnezzar's problems. It's the pride in his own achievements. Verse 4, we read, "There I was, content and prosperous on the roof of my palace." But then all that dream comes, and those terrifying thoughts, and the interpretation, and the clear warning, and even still in verse 29 and 30, walking again on the roof of his palace. "Is not this the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty?" You can understand his thinking, I suppose. You don't get to be a king over most of the known world by accident. I guess he's worked hard. You know, he deserves the accolades for the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, for instance, which were part of the things that he created. He deserves the benefits of wealth and prosperity. And you might argue, and the glory that's associated with it. In fact, you know, that wealth and prosperity and honor and splendor are restored to him by the end of the story. So it's not as if God hates the wealth and the prosperity and the glory and the splendor. So what's the difference there at the start and there at the end? Well, the difference is the understanding of where the glory lays. In verse 29, before his insanity, it's to Nebuchadnezzar's glory. By verse 37, at the end, when it's been restored to him, it's all, he says, to God's glory. "I praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven." See, pride is probably the biggest stumbling block to a saving faith in God. Pride can make us blind to the obvious, like it can here with Nebuchadnezzar. You know, what else explains his failure to hear what Daniel's saying and to change? It's just that pride, isn't it? Pride in all I've achieved. Pride in surely, with all this around me, you know, nothing can go wrong despite the dream. Maybe there's just a chance that that's not true and all of this will protect me. And it's true for us, isn't it? How many times have you seen folks fall away from the faith? And the message is, I just need my own space. I just need to live my own life for a while. I need to enjoy my own experiences and satisfy my own desires. It's pride. It's a refusal to acknowledge the sovereignty of God. And how often do you and me, as believers even, fail to live life in all its abundance? And we look on in disbelief as we hear testimonies of people's answered prayer and miracles and how God's speaking to them, whilst for us, he seems cold and distant. Maybe it's pride. Maybe we're still walking in our own strength and not giving all of our life over to all of God, failing to trust him completely for everything. And sometimes it's because, "I don't want to bother you, God. You said it, didn't you, Derek?" You know, sometimes we feel sort of guilty. "Oh, God's busy doing this, and this. I'll just get on with this because I know I can do it. I know it'll be okay." You know, sometimes it's good motives. But actually, it's pride. And that pride cuts us off from God. It's a refusal to acknowledge the sovereignty of God. Dress it up how you want. It's pride. And Nebuchadnezzar discovered, as we surely will, everything he does is right and all his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. The power of a sovereign God, the pride of a sinful person. And the answer, and you know this, and it's simple but it's profound, is acknowledging his sovereignty and trusting him for everything. But just two other aspects, just briefly. First one is the discipline of a loving father. Because it's just possible, isn't it, when you read a story like this and you see the 7 years of insanity with long hair and curled nails and sleeping with the cattle and having dew on you in the morning, that you might just think that God is a vengeful, punishing, harsh taskmaster. Something actually that Nebuchadnezzar doesn't think, but you might, because this all seems a bit over the top. Well, there's a New Testament angle to this passage, and you'll find it in Hebrews chapter 12 and verses 5 to 13. It's not just a New Testament angle, because it's just a commentary, really, on those Old Testament verses there in the middle from Proverbs in verse 5 to 6. Proverbs 3, 11 and 12. The writer says this in verse 5. You have forgotten that word of encouragement that addresses you as sons. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline, and do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes everyone he accepts as a son. Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as sons. For what son is not disciplined by his father? If you're not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are illegitimate children and not true sons. Moreover, we've all had human fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of our spirits and live? Our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best. But God disciplines us for our good, that we may share in his holiness. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. Therefore, strengthen your feeble arms and weak knees. Make level paths for your feet, so that the lame may not be disabled, but rather healed. The point to learn from Nebuchadnezzar's story, as well as from these verses, is that this sovereign God who inflicted this insanity on Nebuchadnezzar was then, is now, a loving God. He's the father of us all. He's the father who delights in his children, picking up what Andy brought to us this morning. He has our best in mind in everything he does. So, Derek, let's think about turbulence. You know, the Lord was trying to teach you something. Let's see him as a father who's trying to teach you something. But what he was trying to teach you was, I'm the one who can still a storm. If the turbulence had carried on and carried on and carried on, and you'd been shaken to bits over Memphis, your testimony, I hope, would still be there, but different, because he'd have given you peace in your heart. I mean, that's what you were looking for, actually, wasn't it? But he was taking you a step further. Did your dad ever fence over the garden pond when you were young? It's because he loved you and wanted you not to fall in the water. Would your dad not let you play with razor blades when you were a kid? Because he loved you and he wanted to save you from that agony. Did your dad ever refuse to give you everything you wanted? It's because he loved you. And he wanted to teach you how best to live your life. And he wanted the best for you. God is in charge, What does that mean? Well, have you ever been bereaved? What about the earthquake and the tsunami? What about when bad things happen to good people? Well, the same principle applies. Danger, there's a loving father at work, trying to save. Trying's the wrong word, isn't it? Saving, teaching, delivering the best for his children. And the best comes when we trust him. And it may be that we don't understand now. It may be that we'll never understand this side of heaven. But trusting in a loving father is infinitely more satisfying than trusting to luck or not knowing the answer to the question why. And it may be the hardest lesson that we ever have to learn, but it's the simplest to understand. And it's the message of the Bible, and it's the message of Daniel, and it's the message of this chapter. Trust in God. Remember, he's the one who loved you so much that he gave his one and only Son. And whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. Discipline of a loving father. And finally, and very briefly, the value of a godly friend. By whom I mean Daniel, who found himself with this God-given opportunity to speak hard words to this man who'd become friend, too strong a word. He'd been in a good relationship with this king. These were hard words that he had to say. And he did try and soften them just a tad, but he spoke the truth in love. And he suggested a way out. And then when he was ignored and all these things came to be fulfilled, presumably because this letter's here and because Nebuchadnezzar is giving his testimony in Daniel's book, presumably Daniel was still around to help Nebuchadnezzar understand and to encourage this testimony. Daniel was a godly friend and showed his value to Nebuchadnezzar. And just to pick up on the theme of last weekend, and I know some of you went there when we went away for the weekend, but in his wisdom, God has provided us with each other for such ministry, the value of a godly friend. Can't remember my titles myself, but just to summarize, the power of a sovereign God, the pride of a sinful man, the discipline of a loving father, and the value of a godly friend.